Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me to give this presentation, and thank you all for turning out. It was a really great turnout. I didn't expect to see you all here, but it's great to, it's really not nice to see you. So, having a talk on Africa in the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE is very apropos. There's inequality in spades in sub-Saharan Africa. So let me just show you a couple slides to set the mood. So here we see that sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America are the two most unequal regions in the world. It's kind of a stereotype-defying fact or factoid, because people used to think, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, that there was great equality of poverty in African countries. But in fact, now we see that the Africans are right up there with the Latin Americans in terms of inequality. And this interesting slide that comes from the same source, an IMF 2015 study on inequality in sub-Saharan Africa, shows us this log of GDP per capita, real GDP per capita, and the net Gini index, these red dots of the African countries. We see that even the richer African countries are highly unequal, and you know, if you drew a line through the dots, you would conclude that as they become, on average, as they become richer, they become more unequal. So there's plenty of inequality in sub-Saharan Africa, and in fact, kind of a perfect storm of predictors, really, for within country inequality. We have poor countries, which tend to be more equal anyway, agrarian countries, most of them, which tend to be more unequal than other countries, many mineral dependent, which is also another predictor of inequality, weak states, predictor of inequality, and highly open economies. So just on just about every single of these gross predictors, we would find some of the correlates or possibly determinants of inequality in African countries. And then, of course, as you know, there's also very high poverty. So the red line here is poverty headcount, percentage of the population. And those red bars are the African countries. Not surprising, but one thing that's interesting, you know, one of the things that this particular chart just picks up starkly is this, the falling green bar for East Asia. So during the time when inequality rates in East Asia have plummeted, in Africa they have remained very, very high. So what my project is about is thinking about the causes and, or one way to put what it's about is thinking about the causes and effects of inequality in African countries. We already talked about some possible, you know, aggregate causes, but are there other causes that are less visible, that are more obviously man-made or man-selected, human-selected, institutional causes, other sorts of social causes, and what are the effects? How do these very, very high rates of inequality in sub-Saharan Africa affect politics, for example, policy choice and policy making? And to answer those questions, what this project does is look at the distribution of productive assets, focusing in particular on land. So what do land politics look like in these very, very highly unequal societies? And it's a project in, you know, sort of writ large terms, in terms of a 5 or 8 year project, that is about conceptualization as well as about data gathering and hypothesis making. And it has required quite a lot of conceptual innovation, and you know, you can tell me if you think it's any good so far, quite a lot of conceptual innovation to figure out how to get our heads around this problem. So here's an outline of what I would like to do today. First, very generally introduce this topic of land law reform in African countries. So African countries are in the process of rewriting land laws. It's sometimes a quite massive rewrite. So I'd like to introduce that and use that as a segue into the example of Kenya, which was the site of this international LSE International Inequalities Institute funded pilot project that I did with my team in 2016. So we introduced the Kenya example by way of just kind of just talking very generally about land law reform, but then launch on a more general project here, first talking about how we even begin to conceptualize land institutions and land tenure institutions in African countries. Then talk about the policy choices that citizens and groups and countries are facing in this era of quite radical land law reform in many African countries. Then get to this challenge of thinking about preferences, or preferences of different kinds of social actors and groups, preferences around land policy in these very unequal settings and also in the face of rising inequality. And here I want to talk about inequality not only within countries, as illustrated in the Gini's that we looked at before, but also not only national aggregates, but also inequality across subnational regions. Take into account the structure of political institutions when trying to think about how preferences play out in the political arena, or might not be aggregated into policy. And then present some hypotheses that I have about the structure of land politics in these settings, and that gives me a chance also to return to some of the Kenya material. So that's the outline. Please do stop me if you would like to. This is very informal. So land law reform. So the difficulty, or the main challenge in thinking about land tenure and land law reform, land policy in African countries, is that almost all land is unregistered and untitled. So as this factoid indicates, there's a World Bank number, about 2 to 10% of the arable land in African countries on average, or as an average of country averages, is untitled and unregistered. It's true that rates of titling and registration are higher in Southern Africa, in the Malawis and Zambias, of course, of South Africa and Namibia, we get numbers that look more like 40 or 50%. But for East and West Africa, average rates of land registration and titling across countries, East, West, and Central Africa, the number would be more like 5%. And Kenya is something like 15. But these are very low rates of titling and registration. So that means we don't have cadastral records, we don't have titles, we don't have direct taxation of land, because it's land holding as such is not visible to the state or to the analysts. It doesn't show. We don't have the kind of database that you would want normally to do such a study in pretty much almost all other parts of the world. So that said, we also know that 60 to 70% of the population of most African countries is rural. So I know we talk all the time about these astronomical rates of urbanization in African countries, but still, in most countries, I think it is something like 4 or 5 African countries have less than 50% of the national population in the rural areas. The others are in the 60, 70% range. In Kenya, officially, it's 67%. And then we have many countries like Burkina Faso, where proportion of the population in the rural areas is like 80% or 85%. In Uganda, they still say 85%. So you have this mass of the population, most people in these countries in the rural areas, but living in a sort of institutional arena governing access to resources that is not this familiar system that we know of, titled and registered land that is bought and sold on the market. So how to get our heads around this problem. The next fact that we need to take into account is that it's very important to avoid the temptation of thinking about this problem as one of sort of the absence of the state. Like, well, governments just haven't gotten around to registering and titling, or they don't, state power does not penetrate the rural areas. It was a patently false. There's long histories of state land activism in all, let's say, almost all African countries, outside of maybe the farthest reaches of the Central African Republic, long histories of state activism and state crafting of land regimes and land tenure regimes, just not land tenure regimes that are hinge on registered and titled land. And, you know, this, well, yes, let me say long history of state land activism. So I'll describe more the status quo in a minute, but what I would like to get at right now is just this point about land law reform. So it turns out that around now, in the last 5 or 10 years or so, 5 years even, most African countries have aggressively embraced this agenda centered on the goal of registering and titling all land within a decade. So it's kind of an astonishing project in its scale and ambition and in terms of the socio-political implications of that kind of change. But in fact, there you have it. Kenya, for example, is committed by its new constitution to register and title all land by 2022. Cote d'Ivoire, they're doing the same thing. And we could make a very long list of countries that have embraced this as a national policy goal. So here's the question for my project, or for this part of the project, is really, so what's the political economy character of this issue in these countries? So how is this business about registering and titling all land going down in these countries? And what are the politics that will shape the unfolding of these initiatives over time? And what, you know, what, how can we think about what some of the likely consequences might be? And the plot thickens because most people, let's say, if I were giving this talk in the World Bank, or, and even many observers, let's say, in the NGO world, just think, hey, that's a great idea. Let's register and title all land. What's the problem? You know, it's just unproblematically obvious thing. We just hand out land titles to people. And expect little by way of divergent interests around this issue. But in fact, that could not be further from the mark. And there's, you know, massively turbulent politics in most African countries around precisely this issue. Cote d'Ivoire, where I started studying this problem about, you know, quite a long time ago, had a terrible civil war around land registration and titling, and they're really still not out of it. And in the case that we're about to talk about briefly, Kenya, the politics that we study is extraordinarily contentious and divisive politics around this land registration and titling issue. So what I would like to then work on is explaining this. So what is the structure of the bargaining around land and land policy? How can we even get our heads around this? And if we can see or describe what's going on in one country, how would we undertake to compare across countries? Like, is Burkina Faso the same as Tanzania, or is Kenya the same as Uganda? How can we get a fix on this and then compare? So that's the project. Here are some questions. Why is there conflict around titling? We already touched on that. Sort of a subset of that, or maybe part of the answer, is what is the structure of preferences around titling? And then we can talk about the preferences maybe in the abstract, but then how does that relate to the observed, if we can observe, let's say we can, well, how does that relate, how does the structure of preferences relate to an observed structure of competition around land law? And you could, in the abstract, generate some hypotheses about what preferences and the structure of competition might look like. So you could say, well, I think there's going to be class competition around land registration and titling. Or there could be regional competition. There could be ethno-regional competition. There could be core-periphery. There's strong core-periphery dynamics in most African countries. There could be sectoral, agricultural land versus land destined for other uses. And, you know, in the press now and in the scholarly work on land politics in Africa, you know there's a huge literature on land grabbing. So we might also think that one line of cleavage around land policy could be this line of cleavage that hinges on the national ownership versus foreign ownership divide. So there's plenty of hypotheses about what the structure of competition could be that you might be able to generate in the abstract. And, you know, they're all sort of here, but that's what I would like to do is go beyond that kind of very general approach. And the argument that I can make in the abstract, and I'm kind of in the process of working on the data part, but that if we understand the initial conditions, if we have a good idea about the initial distribution of land at time one, and then we look at the pattern of inequality across regions mostly, but also a little bit within regions, we have the key to explaining divergent policy preferences in this arena. And we can make a kind of abstract model that helps to predict or generate hypotheses about different African countries, and then we can go look for the empirical implications of those models. And the problem can be set up like this. We can ask about preferences around land market promoting policies or preferences around market restraining versus market promoting policies, so preferences about the market, like to what extent do actors want to see heightened commodification of land. That's one dimension of choice. And a second dimension of choice, which is, you know, really completely imbricated with this, is the politics around the choice of land administration institutions. Because it is not just, you know, the policies per se regarding the market or commodification, registration, entitling, turning land into a commodity, but also choices around the kinds of political institutions that will govern land markets or that will govern the extent of commodification of markets. So it's really a kind of two-dimensional policy space that I would like to talk about. And I can come back to that in a few minutes. But let me bring in the Kenya business now. So this is what I have been working on and what I'm interested in. And what I did with the LSE International Inequalities Institute funding in 2016 was to launch, we called it a pilot. Maybe this could have been called exploratory, because it was very pilot project in Kenya, looking at sort of land politics in the wake of Kenya's 2010 new constitution, which was a kind of a radical move toward devolution, creating a semi-federal system in Kenya out of what had been a strongly unitary state, and a new set of land laws in 2012, that land laws that were supposed to promote this registration and titling, but also sort of transform the structure of land administration and reallocate prerogative from the center down to these newly formed counties. So there was an institutional transformation, but also a substantive transformation in land policy. So the research designed around our project, or what we thought we could do, is that we have this sort of external shock of these national level changes, and then we could go observe in the counties different ways in which different counties were responding to the challenges and opportunities created by the national level change. That was sort of the idea. And you know, we don't have, this is kind of very qualitative on the ground, sleuthing and interviewing and reading the newspaper and talking to people and actually watching politics in these counties. And so what we did was we made a team of researchers that here's our team, and our team members who were graduate students from the University of Nairobi and Kenyatta University selected pairs of counties and went out and gathered data, sort of a structured focused comparison type of thing, to gather similar data across each of the eight counties in a way that would just give us, it's not a representative sample, but that we did get some dispersion across different county types, and it really just to kind of get a sense of what sort of variation existed out there, just to brainstorm about variation. So these, I just am showing this because the project was funded from here in large part, but we were hosted by the British Institute in East Africa. And so this Catherine Gutierrez, she's a PhD student at Kenyatta University in urban planning. She has subsequently defended her thesis. This Seth Uma was doing a master's at University of Nairobi in history. He completed the master's, he submitted it. We congratulated him. He's at Oxford right now doing a DPhil. This guy, James Owino, completed and submitted an MA in history at the University of Nairobi while we were working. We're very happy we got him through the pipeline, and now he's working for the government of Kenya on conflict warning monitoring in the north, which is a big part of our project, and this, Achiba Gargule, is actually a PhD student in anthro from the University of Bern, but he's doing us, he's a Kenyan national from Isiolo in northern Kenya, and we were able to fund part of his field research. So we were really happy to have these people going out into the counties and gathering data. So this is how we worked in our sort of joint workshops where everybody would come back together at the British Institute in East Africa. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to introduce what this, I have to do this, I'm sorry. This is Alex Deisenhaus. He was a research associate at the BIEA. Now he's a PhD student in political science at Cornell. And he was the guy on the ground who really really ran our team. I remembered that. This is Alex here. Anyway, this is how we worked. And the results that we got were, I mean, actually really messy because of the intensely politicized, chaos that was unleashed by the devolution and the new land laws and the intensely politicized, sometimes, even sort of violent local responses to the provisions of the new laws. And so we didn't really get a clear read on all our indicators, but we were able to describe very divergent responses to the opportunities offered to these county level governments in the land administration domain. Very divergent responses. So kind of sort of as predicted, and we use this to, or I can fold these counties into my study, but we also use it to kind of, in a hypothesis generating way. But we have this humongous working paper that we put up in ID. It's 80 pages. Elliot Green read it. Thank you. He made his way all the way through it. And these were our initial results. But this is one case, one place, and one year. And really, it's a kind of as I said, sort of an exploratory data gathering thing, but what I'm trying to do is to scale up. And I have another little project going on in Cote d'Ivoire, which is also a place of a lot of land turbulence, but so the Kenya stuff is grist for the mill, and we still hope to do a couple papers on Kenya. But anyway, let's now go back to the more general structure of the problem. So, this is kind of the problem of understanding the prevailing institution. So I already told you what is absent. Registration and titling is largely absent in, let's say, 80 to 90% of agricultural land. So that's absent. So what is present? So speaking very schematically and in a stylized way, the prevailing institutions are these so-called neo-customary land institutions, which I would like to insist are products of intentional state design. This is not just some, holdover from, the olden days that has always been there. These are products of intentional state design made during the colonial period. So to get a handle on this neo-customary land business, what is very important to understand is that actually the state is the owner of all this unregistered and untitled land in African countries. So some land lawyers who work in East Africa really describe this neo-customary land tenure as permissive occupancy or permissive tenancy sort of granted by the state. And I think that kind of understanding helps us to get to where we want to be. So the states are the owners of the untitled land. So let's talk about, think of the regime, I'll try to use this later, as the Group A. Although I do not yet have a formal model. I would be very happy if one of you could make one for me. So under the prevailing rules, the state, using these neo-customary land tenure regimes, divides the national territory into ethnic homelands, into blocks, ethnic homelands, wherein state-recognized members of state-recognized ethnic groups, let's say ethnic group B, C, and D, have entitlements in principle, some people do get entitlements, to access to land in their ethnic homeland. That's the basic model. So you have to be a state-recognized member of a state-recognized ethnic group. So there's a strong insider dimension, the sort of paralleling the insider-outsider distinction that we have in the labor market politics in the advanced industrial countries. But these insiders, of state-recognized members, state-recognized groups, have entitlements within their homelands. The origins of these systems can be described in a way that's very analogous to the way we understand the capitalist welfare state. We can say that these neo-customary land regimes emerge out of a historical configuration of actors, let's say, regional actors at a critical juncture in national histories in the 1920s to 1940s when the colonial states, the colonial overrule was trying to consolidate its hegemony across space within the African colonies. So these land regimes, in a way, emerge out of a kind of social contracting or bargaining between states and the people who were in these places under colonial conquest. And the colonial state actually comes up with this, similar to what you saw in some parts of India, comes up with this kind of entitlement or bargain in a way that is, you know, sort of quite constraining in some ways, but on the other hand, includes this entitlement. And the political character then of the regime can be understood like this. These land tenure regimes do work to decommodify land and labor because they keep the land off the market. And under the entitlement, let's say imagined, you know, in a very stylized way as a household or lineage entitlement, it also radically restrains the commodification of labor. It provides a kind of social safety net function because people with land can feed themselves and also participate in the market if they produce for the market. It is, in terms of political character, a way of dividing territory amongst groups and creating groups also, but dividing territory amongst groups, and they permit an iota of group political autonomy because within these homelands there are these state recognized, sometimes on the payroll, so-called customary leaders that are pivotal in local land allocation and do some other sorts of political things within these homelands. So what I would like to try to keep moving us toward is an idea of these ethnic land entitlements as a kind of analogous to, you know, a fiscal allocation, kind of entitlement, a kind of a social policy in the welfare state. So in this analogy, the land allocation substitutes for a kind of fiscal entitlement in terms of social safety net, access to work, access to shelter, access to food. And actually, it makes a lot of sense that in very cash-poor states, as these are, that kind of making these kinds of social contracts and these kinds of entitlements through the allocation of land, you know, it makes sense that this will work for them. I have this dramatic map that illustrates this idea. This is a colonial map of tribes, what the British called tribes in Zambia. It's called Tribal Territories of Zambia. So this depicts the division of the state, the national or the colonial and then post-colonial territory into ethnic homelands, denoted by these colors. One of the things that I like about this map is that this was published as the official atlas of Zambia right through the 1970s. So this idea of the tribal homelands and all this kind of stuff is sort of old-fashioned. It's certainly, you know, it's kind of old-fashioned, but this persists as a kind of a deep structure. And what this shows is literally the division of the national territory into these blocks. These are names of, you know, we call them ethnic groups now, but the colonial authorities, for the colonial authorities, these were the tribes like the Lala here, and these boundaries are here, and you can also see some subdivisions within, all these subdivisions within the larger block territories. This is a way of dividing up land amongst state-recognized groups of people.
So when you say, like, the LTRs, that you have the entitlement in your homeland, is that part of the 2010 Land Act? Or have they always had entitlement to land in their homelands?
So right now I'm not only talking about Kenya anymore. Right. So the 2010 Constitution in Kenya and the 2012 laws propose universal registration and titling throughout the national states of Kenya. And so what they're saying, so Kenya, let's say, speaking very loosely, we could make a map like this of Kenya. So the idea of universal titling and registration, individual titling and registration, is that you break up these territories. You don't have this model anymore. You have these individual properties that can be transacted on the market.
So that act would get rid of these like entitlements in homelands?
Everywhere in Africa, registration and titling will get rid of these entitlements.
Okay.
Exactly. That's kind of where we're headed. I mean, If we had a better map, I mean, there would be some nuances. There are some zones in both of these countries of private property, for instance. But anyway, yeah, basically, yeah, you're thinking along the lines that I am. But let's just, so now we're talking about the neo-customary land tenure regimes, which I'm characterizing as the pre-registration entitling status quo, like the status quo ante, the prevailing system. So as an entitlement regime, which is what I would like to suggest, one of the things that these are, these land regimes, as entitlements, they were designed to target future allocations. That is part of the political character, the political contracting. They have limited the growth of landlessness amongst ethnic insiders since the 1920s until now. It doesn't mean there is none, but it limits amongst the ethnic, the people with the state-recognized entitlements. That also interesting, I mean, this is very interesting for me to realize this, that the limits of these arrangements limit the future possibility of radical alteration in the structure of group-based land inequality. So they constrain government from giving and taking amongst groups. Doesn't mean that it prevents it, but it restrains. If you say, if you think of an agreement made, let's say, circa 1940, it constrains the future growth of land-based inequality among groups. And the prevailing regimes constrain, or even, if the limit, crowd out future allocations by the state. This is partially why these land regimes are costly and so politicized. So this is sort of the political structure generated by these arrangements. However, it is possible that Group A could renege. And, anyway, if we sat here long enough, we could come up with a long list of examples of Group A or those who control the state reneging on these entitlements or allocations. So it's unlikely that they would do so all at once. But incrementally reneging is quite possible, especially because this system, these group-based commitments can be rolled back incrementally. So you could, they're in the sense that they're divisible. So like you could sort of go after Group B and Group C, D, and E could be reassured that they'll still be okay in the future. So what I would say is that, reneging is always possible, but this possibility of reneging, and again, we could have a long list of cases where there has been reneging, it incentivizes groups to remain politically mobilized to defend this entitlement. So it incentivizes them to remain, present and active and assertive in order to raise the cost to the central authorities of reneging. And so this, we start to see some of the elements that we might see in the present setting. So, all right, so that's a kind of very stylized, obviously, way of describing the status quo, as it were. So here we have the choices that are on the table for today. In the individual registration, it's a dramatic departure from the status quo. And the question is, will countries maintain these decommodifying commitments and the present pattern of land allocation amongst groups and also to some extent within families and communities, or will they go for this declared embrace of the market? Yes?
I just have a quick question. So you're describing the neo-customary laws, the ones that are status quo at this point. Did you at all look at what was there? Basically, I want to figure out if the colonial institution simply reinforced existing ethnic or tribal territories, or if they recreated new ones, because I'm Kenyan, and land is like the biggest problem there is, and it will always do reasons why people fight, and there's always a lot of conflict trying to figure out we're here before they came, and that kind of thing. So did you at all look at if they reinforced pre-existing, or if they kind of removed everybody from place to place?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So if, let's say you're looking at all of Sub-Saharan Africa, you would find the entire range of scenarios where sort of more or less, so situations that wherein these neo-customary jurisdictions look kind of like or sort of largely like, very familiar to the people there as, something that existed 300 years ago. And then you can find ones that just come absolutely out of nowhere. So there is a whole range. And So that's on the jurisdiction or the territorial aspect. But in terms of the land administration aspects of the neo-customary land regimes, like who allocates, who adjudicates, under what condition, you know, these are very intensively designed by colonial and post-colonial government. Yeah, very intensively sort of recreated. So that a lot of that internal machinery is quite new. So here's just this, I think we've already touched on this. So what I would like to say here is that in most African countries, these land market questions, so this choice on, along this continuum of what do we prefer, market promoting or market constraining policies, is happening in the context of devolution and decentralization. So there's a sort of radical change in state structure and land, the structure of the institutional machinery for governing land happening at the same time as the laws themselves are changing. So we have not only the market promoting or market constraining, but what I've modeled here is basically the choice between land institutions that hinge on a very weak central authority. So say heavily devolved or decentralized institutions, a weak central authority. So that would be a necessary condition for segmented policy. And if you have markets, segmented markets. So high degrees of regional or local specificity. And then here at the other end of the continuum, a national land policy whereby there's a homogeneous policy that land laws that prevail throughout the national space enforced by a strong center. And importantly, the creation of a national market. A national market means anybody can buy and sell land anywhere. So a segmented market would probably mean something like if you are from the only people from the Northeast can buy land in the Northeast, something like that. So this is kind of the structure of choices. And then just to make this more intuitive, I put the World Bank here. So this is obviously, you know, for them, any real deviation from this is almost unthinkable. Although, you know, some units within the World Bank have become a little more mellow, but, you know, this is kind of like a pure national land market would fall into this cell. And then down here, we have just a stylized kind of extreme of heavily decommodifying, very protectionist regime. So it's protectionist in the sense that the regional or subnational market is somehow protected from the full force of competition that it would be exposed to were there a unified national market. So what about the preferences? So we're going to assume that market promoting policies will benefit those who will be strong players in the market. So those who have money and those who have access to the machinery of state. The legal and bureaucratic machinery that you must go through to register and title your land. So they are those who prefer the obvious beneficiaries, and we can also anticipate that the move toward open full commodification, open markets will redistribute land toward these people. And in fact, that's an express goal of the World Bank, is to put the land in the hands of those who can use it. So it's not really hyperbolic to suggest that this will be what happens. So this kind of market promoting policy that prevails throughout the national space in a unified way will tend over time to concentrate land in the hands of these people. Now, this is kind of a controversial statement. The losers are those who depend on existing entitlements. I think this is true in terms of a political analysis. This is largely true in the short run. So somebody like a real believer in the scenario of igniting land markets might believe that the transformation of agriculture will jumpstart national growth and that in the long run, the structural transformation of the economy will benefit everyone. So we'll just say, well, that's possible. But in terms of the political struggles that I'm interested in right now, we're going to say that the losers are those who depend on the existing entitlements, and that this is the main line of cleavage, and that the rising inequality in African countries, so more or less as we saw on the first slide, and rising regional inequality accentuates the differences in land policy preferences. So we're going to have then rich versus poor regions and rich and poor persons within each region. That's the sort of layout. The structure of institutions, well, I made this slide for David. Soskis, yeah, because he likes to hear about the institutions. So we have just the territorially fragmented political system with regional representation. So it's just the territorial fragmentation of the system is the aspect that I would like to highlight here. So the devolution enhances the fragmentation of the political system or the institutions through which these preferences will play out, at least in part. Most Anglophone African countries have single-member district electoral systems, so all these factors come together to magnify the salience of these geographically concentrated constituencies with at least some shared interests, and they have collective action capacity because of the existing political and social machinery that exists within these ethnic homelands. So this gives us the element of a, well, I'm sorry, I don't really mean to suggest that we're just kind of loading up, heading to a big regression. This is just a model, a theoretical model, if you want. We can analyze these countries as political unions with these strongly devolved, political fragmented political structures with strong regional inequalities. So that is the structure of the game. So this is a way of generating hypotheses about how regions will respond to the specter of land commodification. So this obviously is a typology. So we start at the top with poor and rich regions. We divide the columns by the poor regions and the rich regions, and then take into account, sorry, I should have mentioned this in terms of political structure, whether or not they're aligned with the center. So is the region, let's say, in power, if you want. So in the poor regions, some are marginal regions with, you know, politically excluded, if you want, and some poor regions are aligned with the center, and sometimes they even control the center. And here we have the rich regions. The rich regions that control the center, we can kind of see where this line of reasoning is heading, but there are also rich regions that do not control the center in many African countries. This is always a big source of a lot of political fireworks. So the prediction is that the rich regions, generally the rich regions will favor the market promoting policies, and the poor regions will not, and the rich regions will prefer a national land market because these are regions in which people can go out and buy, participate land in markets and become landowners in regions other than their own. So if their homeland is, or if they're indigenous to Group A or Territory A or B, they will be able to go participate in land markets in Territory D under a national land market. Whereas the poor regions will prefer this segmentation because it protects them from this outside competition. But here, with respect to the powers of the center, and especially the power of eminent domain of the center, we start to see a slightly different configuration of the preferences. So the rich region controlling the center, obviously, they would like a very strong center that can enforce the national policy everywhere. This region, because of the structure of the situation, will seek a federal solution. And similarly, the poor marginal region has absolutely nothing to gain from a strong center. But the poor region that controls the center has a more difficult choice. They might go for the strong. And then here I just tried to, in this typological depiction, think about whether the interests of rich and poor persons within the region will converge or diverge from what is described in the first three lines. And here we can talk more about this if you want, but you can see a lot of reasons why the political leaders in this region, the rich persons, would be very interested in retaining their political base amongst the poor people in their region. So that is sort of the main source of their clout within the national system is their base. We predict convergence. But in these cases, there will be more tension. And What this can do so far is to kind of predict different sorts of scenarios or positions that the different regions might adopt under the prospect of this universal registration entitling. So a defensive ethno-regionalism. This could be an offensive ethno-regionalism in the sense that these people could seek to expand their regional advantage, given their structural disadvantage, but the fact that they're powerful politically. This region will be largely neutralized, the rich region that doesn't control the center because of its defensive position. But in these regions, the rich regions that control the center, we can expect a lot of aggressive pushing of the market, but a lot of class tension within the region because of the class tensions within the region because of this strong divergence between the interests of rich and poor. So the poor people in these regions are the ones who are interested in defending their entitlements. And then I know we've been going for a long time, but what I've tried to do here in the bottom is kind of array at least our Kenya counties across these cells, and you can sort of do so. And I try to bring in some of the other subnational cases I have from some of the other countries that I'm studying. So what I would say is that it kind of generates a model that has empirical implications that are, you know, sort of you know, possibly quite potent in anticipating what kinds of politics and what kinds of coalitions you might see around land. And one that, you know, can be tested, although it's quite labor-intensive to generate the information on the regional responses. I'm not going to talk about the Kenyan case right now. We can come back to that if you want, but I just selected two extremes from a poor, marginalized region and a rich region that controls the state, which, you know, it's probably too easy, but they certainly illustrate dramatically the predicted divergence of interests. But here's something about what you can, other things that you can say, sort of kind of scaling up from this problem. So the first point's already been made, that the existing structure has not only constrained commodification, but has worked to preserve a given structure, or deepen maybe, structure of regional inequality or inequalities across subnational regions. The class interests of the elite or class-like interests of the elite will surely be regionally differentiated in contrast to what some more simplified accounts might suggest. And these regionally differentiated interests of the elite will also play out in terms of popular mobilization, because these people will have an interest in mobilizing their people, their regional constituencies around their land policy preferences. It means that, I mean, just you can deduce from this that governments would be unlikely actually to push for unified markets because of the anticipation of this turbulent politics. And in fact, that is kind of what we're seeing in African countries and have observed over the course of the last 20 years when these ideas have come on the table in different ways. But, you know, it's kind of gets more interesting in a way, because this kind of reasoning and this kind of model predicts a lot of stasis. I think, you know, this kind of structural kind of reasoning that factors in, importantly, the way the institutions shape the choices tends to generate these predictions about stability. So then we have here, how do we explain all the change and disruption that we do see? And I think it's quite interesting to kind of flip the question around and ask in this way. So how do these national programs for registration and titling get as far as they do in the face of all of these stasis generating mechanisms? And one possible answer, I mean, I think there's a lot, but one is that it's possible to argue that in many African countries, actually the interests of the elite are becoming more and more detached from the interests of these electoral constituencies, and even the interests of their regional constituencies. And that, too, is a function of a lot of different kinds of inequality. And then, finally, we should expect the specter of loss of entitlements under registration and titling to provoke response. We surely should. It doesn't necessarily mean that they would be categorically against any kind of registration, but we could certainly predict that these people who depend heavily on entitlements would want very restrictive titling. So forms of registration and titling that are partially decommodifying. Like what we had in Texas, when I lived in Texas, homestead policies where the property on which you lived and the 5 acres around it could never be seized by the bank in a foreclosure. We call them homestead laws. So these are forms of registration and titling that are protective of the subsistence interests. And so I would say we should expect a strong interest in those forms in African countries. And if we don't see pushing for that, or if we don't see resistance to the alternatives, we should really ask why. All right. Thank you. Thank you for listening. That was a long